Mr. Van Spanner, we could comment on the reports that from the press that Saddam Hussein has sent money to the families of Palestinians who were suicide bombers. We could comment on that in the context.
And all I can say is,
the question
was, is it correct that Saddam Hussein has sent money to Palestinians who were victimized in the struggle for, well, you choose the word you want to use, but who were victimized? And the answer is yes, he has. And some criticize it in the Middle East. They appreciate it. And that Saddam Hussein is a political animal, we all know. And I can only repeat, yes, it is correct. Fairly steep amounts, $25,000 for a person who lost his life in independence, and various amounts for lesser damage to the body of those who participated in the civil strife. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you a question. Your expertise is with the United Nations. I don't believe the United Nations has ever actually justified what the United States is doing to Iraq. I wonder if you can say something about what mandate the United Nations has ever given, if that's been carried out, or if something more than that has been carried out, and what the redress for that is within the United Nations. Is there some way to bring the United States into a meeting with the United Nations to sit on this?
Thank you. That gives me the opening to quote you only one article in this United Nations Charter. That's the charter that is binding on all our nations. And the basis for maintaining sanctions against Iraq is Article 39 of that. And it reads, the Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression. Now, that reads quite all right, but if we were now in this room asking ourselves what constitutes an act of aggression or a threat to peace, we would get many different definitions. And that's the weakness of this booklet, because it's not underpinned with what is in legal language called case law, examples of acts of precedent that one can refer to. So the U.S. says Iraq is a threat to the international community. That's why we do what we're doing. So it is an arbitrary application of international law. Resolutions are very vaguely formulated. And the American State Department at one point said, yes, this is done on purpose. And they call it, now you will smile, constructive ambiguity. So constructive ambiguity, maybe it is constructive in the sense that without the ambiguity, we would never have gotten a consensus among the 15 members of the UN Security Council. In that sense, yes, it is constructive. But it is destructive with regard to the way the sanctions or policies are implemented to the Iraqi people. Until the Cold War came to an end, until that time, there was a certain check and balance in the Security Council. There was no country that had a clear superiority over the others. But today, I'm sorry to say, our senator from North Carolina, Senator Helms, he won the battle. Because he said it very clearly in the UN Security Council once, if you do what is in our interest, we will strengthen you. And if you don't do what we is in our interest, we will marginalize you. And today, I think the UN has become a marginal institution, a bilateralized institution, and therefore cannot function as those wise men and women who met in San Francisco in 1945 wanted the UN to function. Long answer, hopefully a satisfactory one.
I wanted to mention that our host, the Islamic Center, has refreshments in the back of the room. We'll hear from Danielle.
What policies could the United States government change to strengthen the UN?
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you asked a question. First of all, It should be on his bills. And again, I want to tell you how well organized you are. Some years ago, I was in India, the U.S. representative in India, and the bill of the U.S. was $1.5 billion. And someone with a sensitive imagination in America sat down and calculated what that would be on a per capita basis per American citizen, and it came to $11.40. So suddenly the UN was flooded with checks in the amount of $11.40, and the UN Secretary General didn't know what to do with that because we can't accept private donations. So, and some were very humorous. They were published in our internal ICE magazine. One woman had sent on behalf of her husband and her cat, Pat, $3.40 as their contribution towards the U.S. government's contribution to the U.N. Well, I am a little bit facetious here, but the point is, pay up the bills, and for God's sake, don't misuse the United Nations for your own bilateral objectives. Thank you. Thank you, Foster.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Actually, I have a two-part question. My first question is, in your opinion, what are or what is, what are the mechanisms in place that makes it so easy for international law to be broken?
Yeah.
And my second question, I wanted to know if you could elaborate. It seems to be during the time before Iraq went into Kuwait, it seems to be some confusion about what the former ambassador, Glaspie, said or what she acknowledged. And former editor of the Wall Street Journal, June Waninsky, brought this up on the Fox Network, and the host, Bill O'Reilly, said he had never heard of this, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Thank you.
I would say that, in a way, I've already answered your first question by saying that international law, as enshrined in the UN Charter, is so general, it's so intangible, it's so loose, that it can be misused by a very powerful nation if it so wishes. And that makes it easy, in a way, to break that international law as it exists there in the documents. The second question of yours, Ambassador Glaspie's last meeting, the U.S. Ambassador Glaspie in Baghdad in August of 1990, I think it was the 3rd August of 1990, when she met Saddam Hussein and she conveyed to him, so the records say, if there is a conflict between Iraq and Kuwait, we consider that as a regional conflict and we will not interfere. And today historians interpret that as having conveyed the message, if you want to do something, do it, we will see our nose out of it. Is that really so? I'm not sure. But I want, in this context, just to mention that Iraq was part of the Turkish, the Ottoman Empire, for a long time. And when it was under Turkish rule, there was a district called the District of Basra, which is today Iraq, and Kuwait. So there the two, the Iraq and the Kuwait, were under one umbrella as part of the Ottoman Empire. And the Iraqis are referring to that, saying we were one once. And that gave them, so they thought, legitimacy for taking it back. But I don't want to speculate any more about Ambassador Glaspie, except to say after that, she never came back to Iraq. She was out, and I think she had left the State Department.